If we were being strictly accurate about our designations, Alexander Cohen wouldn't be included in this series of American showmen at all. Or rather, if we were really strict about it, only half of him would. Because uniquely among the world's present showmen, Alexander Cohen operates on a truly transatlantic basis. There are plenty of producers who have a branch line in London and a main office on Broadway, or vice versa, but Alex Cohen is the one genuine article so far as a mid-Atlantic policy is concerned. And so, if Oscar Wilde was right when he said that Britain and America were two nations divided by a common language, then a character like Alex Cohen has a double significance as somebody to bring together two cautiously friendly tribes. But if by inclination he's a cosmopolitan, a theatrical citizen of the world, by birth he's a true New Yorker, born there on the 24th of July, 1920. And that makes well over 50 years of being besotted by the theater.
I never had any other ambition, and it never occurred to me to do anything else. I went about it by starting in summer stock, which I think you call repertory. And I rented a little theater in a town called Locust Valley, Long Island, which was as charming as Guildford. The town was, but not the theater. The Red Barn Theater was a beat-up old Red Barn. The seats creaked, and we were an amateur acting company. But we were in business, and that's how I started.
After that, there followed a muddle over the rights of an English shocker called Gaslight, all about a husband who goes mad trying to convince his wife that she's mad. And Cohen ended up working for the management who finally won that battle. The journalist, Rady Harris, remembers him sometime later in a different role again.
The first time I met Alex, he was an agent with the Music Corporation of America. And I suspected then he'd wind up owning the agency. You know, he had great, great drive. Enormous imagination, a great love of the theater, and a great daring. I mean, he would accept challenges, which is terribly important in the theater today. And he's now with offices here and in New York.
Here being London, of course. And it was in 1959 that the banner, an Alexander Cohen production, first began to mean something to London's theatergoers. As it happens, the style of the production that gave Cohen a London hit tells us a great deal about the kind of entertainment he seems to have preferred at that time. Remember this?
Some people like a motorbike, some say a tram for me, or for Bonnie.
Oh, me lorry,
they lay them down and dee. Such means of locomotion seem rather dull to us,
the driver
and conductor of a London omnibus. Oh, but it might please ting-ting, oh, but it might please ting-ting, when you are lost in London and you don't know where you are. You'll hear my voice a-calling, fall further down the car, and very soon you'll find yourself inside the terminus in a London Transport diesel engine, 97 horsepower omnibus.
Along the Queen's Great Highway, I drive my merry-go-round at 20 miles per hour in the middle of the road.
We like to drive in convoys, we're most gregarious. The big six-wheeler's got a painted London Transport diesel engine, 97 horsepower omnibus. Earth has not anything to show more fair.
Mine's there.
Earth has not anything to show more fair. Any more fair.
When cabbies try to pass me before they overtakes, I sticks me flipping hand out and I jams on all me brakes.
Them jackal taxi drivers can only swear and cuss behind that monarch of the road.
Observer of the highway code.
That big six-wheeler.
Scarlet paper.
London Transport.
Diesel engine.
97 horsepower omnibus.
I stops when I'm requested, although it spoils the ride, so we can shout.
Get out of it, we're full right up inside. We don't ask much for wages, we only want fair shares. So cut down all the stages and stick up all the fares. If tickets cost £1 a piece, why should you make a fuss? It's worth it just to ride inside.
30-foot long by 10-foot wide.
Inside that modern comfort
of observer of the highway code.
That big six-wheeler, scarlet painted London Transport diesel engine. 97 horsepower. 97 horsepower omnibus. Hold for it, please.
Drop of a hat. Flanders and Swan, very English, very idiosyncratic, and essentially small scale. It ran at the Fortune Theatre, whose size is such that in the old days the occupants of Hatfield House or Chatsworth would have described it as servants' quarters. But Drop of a Hat was one of the most successful miniature shows ever staged in London, and it very nearly proved to be the archetype for a whole series of theatrical experience of the kind that Alexander Cohen presented. A year after Drop of a Hat opened in London, Cohen introduced this to New York audiences.
Listen, you, nobody here likes you.
I'm going to faint.
Are you listening to what I'm telling you?
I feel so sick.
You've made yourself thoroughly disliked.
Please, can I have some water?
Just a minute, please. Are you listening to what I'm saying to you?
Oh.
I don't come in here very often, and I want you to understand. You're one of the most disliked patients in this hospital,
Doctor,
and you've done it.
Doctor, I've been calling for you for about a week.
Now, I've had numerous complaints from the nurses. You're ringing the bell, you're asking for medicine, you're doing this, you're doing that. You know, we're not running the hospital only for you.
Doctor,
you know that, don't you?
I faint a lot.
Well, if you're fainting, then we'll take care of it in the morning when I come around teaching the interns.
Oh.
But there's no reason to carry on and fuss like this. Make yourself a nuisance to the nurses. They have a great many people on their hands, you know.
The little thing fell and my foot is down on the floor
now.
Now,
you cannot treat people this way. For $150 a day, you know, that doesn't make you our boss.
It's so heavy in the cast.
We work for the hospital.
Well, can you just pick it up and put it on? It's weighing my whole body now.
I'm trying to help you, Mrs. Detsky, because if you don't change your attitude, you're going to be a very unhappy lady. These nurses don't have to come in and change the sheets, you know. They cannot do those things.
The sling broke.
It's a lot of work for them shoving you around that bed.
4 days ago, and it's just been laying on the floor.
Well, there's no talking to her.
An evening with Elaine May and Mike Nichols. The date, 1960, the place, New York. And that gave the Cohen management a hit on each side of the Atlantic. Now, clearly he felt some kind of affinity with the small-scale production that he didn't feel with the more lavish, full-scale gamble of a musical. A suspicion confirmed by a lady with a very special view of what Cohen's personality is like. Hilde Parks, or Mrs. Alexander Cohen.
I think the thing that he's always been attracted to is, I guess, what you call the concert thing, this concept that he started here of the 9 o'clock theater, which opened actually with Michael Flanders and Donald Swann and at the drop of a hat, and then was followed by Beyond the Fringe and then the drop of another hat, and Yves Montand and Marlene Dietrich and Maurice Chevalier, people of that sort. He's always been able to get along terribly well with individual artists. He relates to the material so well. He's a very good editor of that particular kind of material. Good Evening, for instance, was successful in England, but nowhere near what it has been here. And I think that the difference was made by Alex's contribution as a weeder and a pruner and a selector and an organizer. I guess he likes it better because he has a definite contribution to make. He doesn't have that kind of contribution to make, say, to a musical. He probably does tend to the concert thing for that reason.
Well, in more recent years, he's involved himself increasingly with the big musicals, but certainly in the early 1960s, he became a purveyor of the single artist, the solo talent. 1961, for instance, saw him involved in a professional capacity with two concert-type productions, a one-man and a one-woman show. And in case you have any difficulty distinguishing one from the other, this one is the man.
Voici Luna Park. Dans mon usine de plus tôt, on peut dire que j'ai le fin boulot. Ça fait bien 365 jours de long que je vise toujours le même sacré petit boulon. Mais cela ne m'empêche pas de chanter. Dès que j'ai ma petite heure de liberté, je vais tout droit à Luna Park. Dans le jour cru des langues Sahara, sur la chenille, je vois les filles, je vois les filles, lors de souance en pilou, en pilou, et le pick-up chante comme moi. Travail et c'est ahurissant, pour le corps c'est bien salissant. Quand je touche ma paye vers la fin du mois, je sais qu'à plus tôt il y a des gars plus riches que moi. Mais cela ne m'empêche pas de chanter. Luna Park est ma réserve de gaieté. À tous les stands, je suis salué. Des patrons, des habitués, garçons, des filles, c'est ma famille. Partout ailleurs, je ne suis rien. À Luna Park, je suis quelqu'un. Vive Luna Park et vive la joie. Blade, 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 blade
Yves Montand, who appeared in a show called An Evening with Yves Montand in the same year that Miss Lena Horne toured the United States and Canada with a production called Lena Horne and Her 9 o'clock Review.
I get too hungry for dinner at 8. I like the theater, but never come late. I never bother with people I hate. That's why the lady is a tramp. I don't like crap games with barons and earls. Won't go to Harlem in ermine and pearls. Don't dish the dirt with the rest of the girls. That's why the lady is a tramp. I like the free, fresh wind in my hair, life without care. I'm broke, that's oak. Hate California, it's cold and it's down. That's why the lady is a tramp. Now I go to Coney, the beach is divine. I go to ball games, the bleachers are
Lena Horne, who worked for Alex Cohen in the same year that Yves Montand did concerts for him. Well, up till now, there's been something about most of the Cohen musical productions which suggests certain words like conventional, predictable. Well, whatever the word, that changed once and for all in 1962, when from being an organizer of one and two artist recitals, Cohen suddenly got himself involved with four men at the same time, whose apparent intent was to question a great many of the things that the British in their innocence thought that the theater stood for. In the event, it stood for practically anything.
Well, anyway, so I said to him, I said, do you do vest in mauve? And he said, no, we don't do vest in mauve. And so I said to him very sharply, I said, don't do vest in mauve? And he said, no. So I had to settle for the green, the Lincoln green. It made me mad, I'm telling you. Well, never mind, as long as it's woolly. That's well, a nice thing. Oh, God, I'm falling to bits. I really am. Hello, what have we got today, Arthur?
Hello, love. Today we've got bollards.
Well, sounds exciting. What is it, a girdle?
No, it's a cigarette.
No, ciggies again.
Hello, men.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I got held up at the hairdresser. Oh, I was so worried about it. I can't tell you. He was going on and on. I said, stop, you'll ruin me.
Go on, tell me what it's like.
Oh, it's lovely from the back. Yeah. You can scarcely see the joint.
Oh, thank you. Very nice.
Oh, it's very nice. Have you seen what I've seen?
No, what?
Clasp your eyes on that
one.
What a lovely tie.
It's a lovely tie. Yeah. It's the new colour.
Oh, what's that?
Yellow, can't you see?
Where'd you get it?
Tommy, I picked it up for a song.
Oh, and a dance.
Okay.
Oh.
What?
Oh, aren't these sou'westers fabulous?
Oh, come on, you are. On to the posing stand now.
Oh, please don't touch me this morning, Arthur.
Get behind your apparatus.
Are you ready, then?
Yes.
Right. Action.
Stormy day at sea, are followed by the smoking of a ball. At once that lovely smoke is swallowed, so much satisfaction.
Smoke bollard, a man's cigarette. Woo!
Beyond the Fringe, one of those theatrical leaps in the dark that worked out more wildly successful than anyone could have suspected at the time, the performers included. Now, why did Cohen take a chance on so anarchic a concept? Well, according to Peter Cook, he took the chance because it was coming cheap.
He produced Beyond the Fringe in New York in 62, 64, and paid us nothing. We're so pleased to be on the stage.
Well, Dudley Moore doesn't go into the financial issues, but feels that Cohen has this knack of pulling fragments together and helping the artists to integrate them into a show.
I think actually Alex is one of the few really good producers. He's been very good with us because when we did the show over here, he really got us at it to sort of improve the show, prune it down and get it to a sort of an essence, which I don't think it was before. You know, I think it's much tighter. And I think he's very good in that way, more useful in that sense than a director to whom we would not give much a veneer anyway, I don't think. But to have somebody say, well, what about that bit there? Does that really work? You know, was very useful. And I think that's his most valuable function, frankly.
Well, I think we roughly knew from Beyond the Fringe, which we didn't change at all for America, that if it was going to work, it would work in English without changing words or anything to adapt to American audiences. And I don't think at any time he suggested we make it more American or cut things out because it would be obscure. But having worked both sides of the Atlantic, he just knew that, so it never cropped up.
I think he's possibly maybe a little nervous about material. For instance, we had a film bit in the show about a black man who goes into a shower and he starts singing Old Man River, very deep bass voice, this being me. Then as he washes, the makeup comes off and he becomes more and more white and ends up with a sort of Noel Coward voice and says, when he's absolutely white, which I am, oh, that's better, and walks out of the shower. And Alex was very afraid of using that in New York at the time. I think actually that was probably a little bit overcautious. I think maybe that's the only area I could fault him on.
Man, river, that man, river.
I mean, I haven't got a really good bass voice, but he ends up, he just keeps rolling around. Oh, that's better.
In 1963, while Dudley Moore, Peter Cook, Jonathan Miller, and Alan Bennett were performing in Beyond the Fringe, the Cohen office returned to a more conventional type of performer. In fact, one of the great surefire box office insurances of the century.
Bye. First you put your tunies close up tight. You swing 'em to the left and then you swing 'em to the right. Step around the floor kinda nice and light. And then you twist around with all of your might. Spread your loving arms way out in space. You do the eagle rock with such style and grace. You put your left foot out and then you bring it back. That's what I call balling the jack.
Oh, don't do me that way. Listen to that man go. He's crazy. I swear he's crazy. Oh, dear. Now follow me closely, real close on this one, and do me after me.
First you put your tunies close up tight. Real close, swing 'em to the left and then you swing 'em to the right.
Oh, you're delicious.
Step around the floor, kinda nice and light. And then you twist around with all of your might. Spread your loving arms way out in space. You do the eagle rock with such style and grace. You put your left foot out and then you bring it back. That's what I call the jack.
Another great surefire box office insurance of the century opened a series of one-man shows. At first, there was a little confusion about protocol, as Alexander Cohen recalls.
Chevalier was something else again. I always called him Maurice. I call everyone by their first name, and I think all people everywhere should. So when I met Chevalier, I said, "Hello, Maurice." He said, "Good afternoon, Mr. Cohen." I said, "You really must call me Alex. You will make me very uncomfortable because I call everybody by their first name." He said, "Well, Mr. Cohen, I will try." But in all the time that I knew Chevalier, I called him Maurice, and he called me Mr. Cohen. He was an extraordinary man. At this first meeting, this was the first time that I was to present him in the Ziegfeld Theater. In a series of artists, Chevalier was to open the series, to be followed by Danny Kaye, to be followed by Jack Benny, and so on. But his was the opening bill, and of course, Maurice had played Broadway before, but with other managements. So he was totally prepared, and he didn't need any conditioning, as other artists do, for the traumatic experience of facing a Broadway opening night. He simply said to me, "What day will we open?" And I said, "Tuesday, February the 12th. He said, "And at what time will the performance commence?" I said, "At 9 o'clock. He said, "Very well, Mr. Cohen, I will be there at 8:30. And indeed, believe it or not, that was the last I saw of Chevalier until that evening at 8:30 o'clock. He has sent in his people, Francois and Madeline Valls, and his conductor and his lighting people, and we all worked together, and then Chevalier showed up for the performance and knocked him dead.
Every little breeze seems to whisper Louise. Birds in the trees seem to twitter Louise. Each little rose tells me it knows I love you, love you. Every little beat that I feel in my heart seems to repeat what I felt at the start. Each little sigh tells me that I adore you, Louise. Just to see and hear you is joy I never knew. But to be so near you thrills me through and through. Anyone can see why I wanted your kiss. It had to be, but the wonder is this. Can it be true someone like you could love me, Louise? Every little breeze seems to whisper, Louise. Birds in the trees seem to twitter, Louise. Each little rose tells me it knows I love you, I love you. Every little beat that I feel in my heart seems to repeat what I felt at the start. Each little sigh tells me that I adore you, Louise. Just to see and hear you is joy I never knew. But to be so near you thrills me through and through. Anyone can see why I wanted your kiss. It had to be, but the wonder is this. Can it be true someone like you could love me, Louise? Anyone can see why I wanted your kiss. It had to be, but the wonder is this. Can it be true someone like you could love me, Louise?
Maurice did that opening performance to extraordinary result, and I went backstage and I congratulated him, and I said, Maurice, it's absolutely extraordinary to see you in such condition. And he said, thank you, Mr. Cohen. And that was that. And we had a fabulous engagement, and 4 or 5 years later, I wanted to present him again, and I realized that he was getting on. And Chevalier was always very proud of the fact that he was able to perform at his age, and his age is something he never hid. So nobody could get him to return to America, and I went to see him outside of Paris, where he lived, and I said, Maurice, he said, yes, Mr. Cohen, I said, I have an idea that we should present you, and we should call the evening Maurice Chevalier at 77. He said, what a lovely idea, Mr. Cohen. And he did come back to New York, and he performed, and he was again a great success, and he sold out, this time at the Alvin Theater. And I had booked him, I think, for 6 weeks. And I then went to him, and I said, Maurice, I'd like to extend the booking. A great managerial mistake always. When you've got an act that's selling out, close the show, because you've probably guessed right the first time with the engagement. And he said, well, if that's your judgment, I will agree. And he did extend the engagement by an additional 2 weeks. And I was then paying Chevalier. I normally wouldn't say this, but in order to illustrate the story, I was then paying Maurice $15,000 a week against a percentage, which is the equivalent of roughly £6,000 a week against a percentage of the weekly box office takings. But he was guaranteed at least the $6,000, and we extended the engagement for a couple of weeks, and that portion of the engagement was very sparse. It was disappointing to me. I realized that I had made a mistake. Here, this marvelous man in the twilight of his career had a sellout engagement, and I had made the stupid managerial mistake of extending it at an improper moment. Well, naturally, Chevalier was very disappointed with the closing fortnight when there wasn't the great business. Then he flew back to Paris, and I said, it was the last time I actually saw him. I said, goodbye, Maurice. He said, goodbye, Mr. Cohen. And about a fortnight later, I had a letter, and it said, dear Mr. Cohen, I realize that the extension of our engagement at the Alvin Theater in New York must have been a bit of disappointment to you, and I'm only sorry that things did not end as well as they began. Ever yours, and it was signed Maurice, and at the top, he then crossed out Mr. Cohen, and he wrote Alex. And enclosed in that envelope was a check for the last 2 weeks of his engagement, returning his salary, which came to £12,000, without any reference in the letter to the check. That was Chevalier.
It was just one of those things, just one of those crazy flings, one of those bells that now and then rings, just one of those things. It was just one of those nights, just one of those fabulous flights, a trip to the moon on gossamer wings, just one of those things. If we thought a bit of the end of it when we started painting the town, we'd have been aware that our love affair was too hot not to cool down. So goodbye, dear, and amen. Dear, hoping we'll meet now and then. It was great fun, but it was just one of those things. It was just one of those things.
Clearly, there was tremendous mutual admiration and affection between Chevalier and Alexander Cohen, and with relationships like that, who needs contracts? In the same year as the first Cohen-Chevalier collaboration, the Cohen office involved itself in yet another one-man show, which underlines yet another thing about him which makes him stand apart from all our other showmen in this series. Cohen is a musical producer, no doubt of it. We've heard more than enough evidence to prove that already, but right from the beginning of his career, way back in that crummy, crumbling theatre with the cracked seats and the invisible audiences, Cohen has split himself in two, not just by having one foot in New York and the other in London, but also by having one foot in what you might call the legitimate theatre and the other in the musical camp. The list of his credits involves some of the most illustrious names and some of the most prestigious successes in the field of straight drama. In 1963, he found a way of combining his penchant for the show in miniature with his feeling for the use of classical language on stage, and Alexander Cohen produced this.
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed. And every fair from fair sometimes declines, by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest, nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee.
Sir John Gielgud, reciting one of Shakespeare's sonnets from The Seven Ages of Man, turned out in the end to be the prelude to an even bigger involvement with the classics. Gielgud now produced, under the banner of Cohen's management, a version of Hamlet, starring Hume Cronyn, Alfred Drake, Eileen Hurley, and Richard Burton.
Now, I am alone. Oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I. Is it not monstrous that this player here, but in a fiction, in a dream of passion, could force his soul so to his own conceit that from her working all his visage wan, tears in his eyes, distraction in his aspect, a broken voice, and his whole function suiting with forms to his conceit, and all for nothing, for Hecuba. What's Hecuba to him or he to Hecuba that he should weep for her? What would he do had he the motive and the cue for passion that I have? He would drown the stage with tears and cleave the general ear with horrid speech, make mad the guilty and appall the free, confound the ignorant and amaze indeed the very faculties of eyes and ears. Yet I, a dull and muddy metal rascal, peak like John o' Dreams, unpregnant of my cause, and can say nothing. No. Not for a king, upon whose property and most dear life a damned defeat was made. Am I a coward? Who calls me villain? Breaks my plate across. plucks off my beard and blows it in my face, tweaks me by the nose, gives me the lie, the throat as deep as to the lungs. Who does me this harm? Wounds. I should take it. For it cannot be, but I am pigeon-livered and lack gall to make oppression bitter. Or ere this, I should have fatted all the region kites with this slave's awful, bloody, bawdy, villain, remorseless, treacherous, lecherous, kindness, villain,
Richard Burton performing some well-remembered words on Broadway for Alexander Cohen in 1964. And as if to underline his tremendous range as a producer and also his general interest in anything theatrical, Cohen moved swiftly from Hamlet, where the hero pretends to be mad, to a show where the entire cast insisted on being mad. The two performers involved were Olsen and Johnson, those two professional screwballs of whom it was said when the pair of them first hit Broadway, "The lunatic asylum has finally been taken over by the inmates." But Olsen and Johnson weren't really crazy at all, or if they were, they were, to use S.J. Perelman's phrase, crazy like a fox. The Olsen and Johnson shows depended on zany humor, perfect timing, very carefully calculated effects, and in the case of the Alexander Cohen production, a few good songs too. One of them was the title song, and it attracted the attention of Louis Armstrong himself.
Hold your hats. The roof is about to tumble in. Holy cats. The walls and floors are crumbling. Hell's a popping. Hell's a popping. Hell's a popping. Whole gang's whooping up hoop-de-doo. Oh my, it's gonna be uproarious. We'll fly high. Tonight we'll be notorious. Hell's a poppin'. Hell's a poppin'. Hell's a poppin'. You invited to the party too. Better look out. Ain't no cookout. We playin' this one by ear. Turn a book out. It's a bash. Signs are unmistakable. What a smash. We breaking all that's breakable. There's no stopping. Hell's a popping. Why not dropping? We won't stop until night is through.
Louis Armstrong singing Hell's a Poppin', the title song from the Olsen & Johnson show that Alexander Cohen produced back in the 1960s. Now, if the keynote of Olsen & Johnson was deliberate madness, one other Cohen production used humor as a destructive weapon to tread all over the great classical traditions and leave them in small pieces for the cleaners to sweep up. Cohen now produced the artist who once sat at the piano playing a very complicated piece with great elegance, and when asked what it was he was playing, replied, "I think it's a piano." Not quite the sort of thing to make a double bill with Hamlet, although Hamlet had once been dubbed the Moody Dane, and here was a case of the Danish fruitcake.
Could play it without the music here, but why should I use my memory when I have the music written down? That's what it says. short piano.
Victor Borge putting a squib under the conventions of Western civilization. As usual, Borge was a resounding success when he worked for Cohen, but when it comes to the relationship between the two men, well, biographers have a stock euphemism to define that sort of situation. With one eye on the libel laws, they usually say that there was no love lost between the two men. Now, here is Alex Cohen on the theme of Victor Borge, and reading between the lines, it seems that one of the problems that both men had to face was that for once there was nothing for the producer to fix or edit. Or at least, if there was, it doesn't sound as though Borge would have been very pleased about it. Or, indeed, about anything.
Borge is a difficult artist to work with. He comes with his preset show. He knows his business. He knows it probably too well. He gets all those laughs in comedy and music. He never misses a one. God knows it's a brilliant act. He keeps you in stitches for two acts and 2 hours. But he was very unpopular in the theater with the people who had to work with him. And, of course, people do have to work with artists in the theater. There have to be sound engineers, lighting technicians, curtain men, property men, and treasurers, and people out front, and managers, and press agents. Borge had great difficulty in gaining the mutual respect of the people who worked with him. But I find that if an artist is difficult, it really isn't my function to pass a judgment. The only judgment I can make is, does that artist give the public what they paid for and more? And you have to say of Borge that for what he does, his show is the best in the world. Because when he says comedy in music, that's precisely what it is, and you can't find a funnier act on the face of the earth.
If time permits, I would like to squeeze in the Minute Waltz by Chopin. This happens to be the first number I ever learned to play while my sister taught me the piano. She was my first teacher. She is a brilliant pianist. She has played all over the world. Piano, of course. You might be surprised to learn that she is my sister, because we do not have the same name. Her name is... I've spoken to her so often. Sis. Well, the Minute Waltz by Chopin, and it won't take long. She's only my half-sister.
Victor Borge, the man who, unlike Maurice Chevalier, never sent the check back. In 1965, the very year that Chevalier did his second series of shows for Cohen, Alex staged what was probably up to that time his most ambitious musical production. It was designed for and eventually presented on Broadway, and it's a convenient halfway point with which to close this first of two programs devoted to Alex Cohen's productions. Let's begin with Mrs. Cohen, Hildy Parks, who worked closely with her husband on this full-scale musical.
It was a fascinating experience because it was the first time that I think I had ever seen from a management point of view the workings of emotion and ego and personality coming into conflict with each other, which we had on that particular show. The book didn't really change. The book was an amalgam of three Conan Doyle stories, primarily Scandal and Bohemia. And it was written by a very talented fellow by the name of Jerry Cooper Smith. And the music was by two Canadians, Marion Grudeff and Ray Jessel, who had done a lot of work in Montreal on the McGill University.
Well, the property that Hildy Parks is talking about is perhaps the most deeply cherished fictional myth in the entire English-speaking world. What Alex Cohen was involving himself with was an all-singing, all-dancing Sherlock Holmes. And it seems from Hilde Park's reminiscence, as well as from subsequent critical opinion, that the Sherlock Holmes musical suffered just a little from the confused nature of its genesis.
When the book first came to us, it had two other authors, a lyricist and a composer, and we did not think that the music was up to the standard of the book, and were able to persuade the author of that. And we had liked the work very much of Gruduff and Jessel, so we put those three together, and they hit it off very well, and wrote, I think, quite a good score for it.
The question is, was it quite good enough? Well, let's judge for ourselves. The Sherlock Holmes musical, entitled Baker Street, is just beginning, and the two leads are playing the obligatory scene in all first acts of all Sherlock Holmes productions of any kind, the one where Holmes does his little cabaret act in The Art of Deduction. And notice how the lyricist nearly falls over backwards to avoid the famous catchphrase that the whole world associates with Holmes. A song by Holmes without any elementary, my dear, anybody.
And it's so simple, sublimely simple, if you learn not just to see, but to observe. Put your brain to work, not just the optic nerve. If you put your mind to use, you will find the most abstruse become so simple. Oh, yes, so simple. Just as simple thing can be. And it's hardly very hard to see he's in the palace guard.
Oh, no, it's simple as ABC.
Now, wait a minute. How did you know I was in the palace guard?
My dear Captain, the line of your sunburn straight across your brow. No cap with a visor makes that mark. And eyes are asked what type of headgear could possibly do that. A brimless bearskin hat. Now, who wears a busby? You answer that, and then all other suppositions you discard. Just guardsmen, and only when on duty in the palace yard.
Well, I'll be bound.
Does it astound? What other possible solution could be found? It's all so simple, absurdly simple. Why do people always fail to realize that it's not enough to merely use their eyes? They keep going round half blind, never using what's behind.
You see, it's simple, absurdly simple. It's as obvious as two and two make four.
Rudimentary deduction, nothing more.
Though at first we were impressed, we see now that at its best it's also simple.
It's more than simple. It's the very essence of simplicity.
No, we cannot disagree.
For as any fool can see,
it's also simple. Oh, yes, it's simple.
Simple.
Easy.
Nothing.
Basic.
Child's play.
Plainly as evidence can be.
It's elementary.
Well, it does have a faint tang about it of a certain talk song musical involving a Cockney sparrow who becomes a great lady. Or is that being wise after the event? Perhaps. But a further complication in the backstage politics of Baker Street centered around the director, Hal Prince, who also had his preferences.
Hal felt more secure with two other composer and lyricists with whom he had worked before, and he wanted some of their work interpolated. Well, that didn't sit well with Gruduff and Jessel, understandably. Ultimately, I think we wound up with a show that was not all of a piece because of that.
Well, whatever the reasons for the partial instead of complete success of Baker Street, nobody could ever accuse the producer of not trying. As a matter of fact, some of his pre-show publicity could be described as above and beyond the call of duty. One of his most devoted staff members, Esther Charkham, describes one tactic.
He imported a fleet of London taxis and policemen's uniforms and transported all the guests from the first night to the first night party.
Leave it to us, Gov. Leave it to us.
Say the word and it's as good as done.
It's done!
What you need, Gov? Look at the speed, Gov. For if it's speed, you need to do the deed.
We'll do it on the run. Just name your fancy, although it may be chancy. We'll fill the bill without a fuss.
And when no other blokes will touch it, not for money nor for love.
Leave it to us, Gov. Leave it to us.
Your response is heartwarming. However, there will be no pinching involved.
How do we get the letters then, sir?
You will merely toss a smoke rocket into the woman's bedroom window. She will assume there's a fire and rush without thinking to save her valued possessions. I shall attend to the rest.
We send up the smoke and he does the pinching. Got it?
You can depend, Gov, right to the end. Everything is safely in the bag.
Well, have you got, Gov? Close the flood, Gov. And in a shot we'll do the lot,
although we're not the ones to brag.
Give us an inkling, and in a twinkling,
it's done and there's nothing to discuss. For if you can't do it yourself, then by the blinking saints above, leave it to us, Gov. Leave it to us.
221 Baker Street ran on Broadway for around 400 performances, but it never quite reached the outstanding heights that everyone had hoped. Cohen's big Broadway musical success was to come a little later with the show that we'll be looking at in closer detail next week. As a foretaste of that show, a reminder that back in the early 1950s, Bette Davis and Ann Baxter had starred in an award-winning movie by Joseph Mankiewicz called All About Eve. The idea to make a musical out of it was really a very orthodox one, because All About Eve, being the story of actors and actresses and critics and understudies, was no more than the old backstage musical without music. In fact, All About Eve actually is all about the unknown girl who goes out on that stage and comes back a star. Under its new title, All About Eve was to give Alexander Cohen the ultimate irony of a producer's life, a great financial success and a considerable financial loss. On Broadway, the show made plenty of money for all its backers, but when it came to London, it was every kind of success except financial. But audiences on both sides of the Atlantic loved it and gave it what the show's title invited, applause.
Well, there we leave Michael Craig and the American Showman for this week, but now here's Benny Green to give us a preview of next week's programme.
Well, that just about takes us up to the first act curtain for Alexander Cohen. But how will our hero make out? In the programme we just heard, we could see how he graduated from the small-scale success featuring a tiny handful of performers to the mammoth headache, where the production costs sound like the national debt and everything depends on a couple of capricious critics. But that's not quite the route along which Alex Cohen's career has proceeded. After he moved out into the world of the large-scale production, he stayed there for a while and then moved back again to the one-man and one-woman shows, then went back to the big musicals again, and shuffled between the two the whole time. The thing that strikes you as you follow his spoor through the 1960s and 70s is that almost everything he did had the element of chance about it. The projects were always unusual and daring, the sort that until you read that Alex Cohen was to do them, you wouldn't have thought of his shows at all. And yet, once you did hear about it, the whole thing seemed so obvious that you wanted to kick yourself for not having thought of it first.
I can't keep them away, so my little piano is working. and night and day. Oh, they call me nuts, la la, the wisest girl on earth. If you might be Camilla, you'd plead for the truth. Now I'll tell you a secret, don't tell a hundred things. For it could be a mistake, though we've always bound to be.
Yes, it was Alex Cohen who put Marlena onto the stage and let her rip. It proved to be one of the greatest theatrical experiences of the decade, because, as Cohen says, Marlena gave them their money's worth five times over and charmed all the critical birds down off the trees. When he did return to more lavish productions, Cohen had a series of shows that either worked well but didn't make anybody's fortune, or were adjudged brave failures by the people who appeared in them. Again, the subjects were very daring. A musical version of The Mad Woman of Shiloh, starring Angela Lansbury.
I think I possibly might have been a disservice to the show in that I came from a long run in MAME, and in that I had played a glamorous, almost contemporary woman. And in Dear World, I played an 84-year-old crone who was allowed by theatrical license to sing and dance and carry on in a fairly perky way. But nevertheless, I had a garish makeup on and my clothes were filled with character and trappings, and there was no resemblance anywhere along the line to the lady that 6 months before they had seen cavorting around in MAME. So I think a great deal of the audience was taken aback and stopped in their tracks and felt as if they'd been cheated.
You can't get more candid than that. And yet the show Miss Lansbury is describing there, Dear World, is fondly remembered by those people who paid to see it. But The Mad Woman of Shiloh is not quite the most obvious choice in the world for a musical. Even more daring would be the presentation of a musical version of how America evolved the Declaration of Independence. But Alex Cohen produced it, and 1776, as it was predictably called, was another of those shows that once seen is often twice seen and then not forgotten. And there was another thing that Alexander Cohen did which covers all the categories that had gone before. It was musical, it was a one-man show, and this time the star was not only an original choice, he wasn't even a performer at all. Next week we'll hear the extraordinary story of how Alexander Cohen got to hear of the ego of songwriter Sammy Kahn and what he decided to do about it.
Call me irresponsible, call me unreliable, throw in undependable too. Do my foolish alibis bore you? Well, I am not too clever, I just adore you. Call me unpredictable, tell me I'm impractical. Rainbows I'm inclined to pursue. Call me irresponsible. Yes, I'm unreliable, but it's undeniably true. I'm irresponsibly mad for you.
Benny Green was looking ahead to next week's American Showman, once again, Alexander Cohen.